You're listening to your community radio station, KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K224CQ Anahola, K284AL Haleiwa. It's time for In the Garden on the Farm. The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, staff, board, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
Aloha and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Robin and Paul, and on today's show, we will pick out a common yet potent weed in our landscapes, delve into some details about planting our summer garden, and find out how to transplant with the least amount of shock. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners like you, in partnership with our generous underwriters.
Aloha, Robin.
Aloha, Paul.
How are you today?
Most excellent. It's just so beautiful to see summer coming on here in our beautiful island and
watching all
the plants grow like gangbusters as that summer solstice approaches.
Loving those late afternoon work sessions, too, after the heat cools down a bit and everything is possible until the later hours. Really feels good.
It really does. I like to go Mediterranean during this time of year, or maybe it's Hawaiian, who knows, and work in the early morning, take a nice break during the middle of the day when it's really hot, and then hit up those late day work sessions. Really get a lot done like that.
Well, we hope our listeners have the time and energy that it takes to garden. I know I'm always scratching and scrounging for the time to do it, but when I get out there, I'm so grateful. So much appreciation and gratitude for everybody who has their hands in the soil today or is even just dreaming of getting out there. And hopefully we can inspire you to jump in. And so we'll jump into our celestial session, getting you inspired about the very timely influences of the heavenly bodies, the moon, and how it affects our potential activities in the garden and farm. We'll start with our Hawaiian moon of the day. Today's moon phase brought to us by the 2015 Hanalei Moon and Tide Calendar from the Hanalei Watershed Hui. Thanks as well to the U.S. Naval Observatory for precise timing of the movements of the heavenly bodies. And today's Hawaiian moon is Mahealani once again. Very exciting. This is what is considered by the traditional Hawaiian practice as the true full moon, even though it usually falls a day after the astronomical full moon, which was indeed yesterday. But Mahealani will rise over Kauai tonight at 8:34 p.m. She'll reach her transit or highest point in the sky at 2:15 a.m. early tomorrow morning, and she'll set at 7:56 a.m. 98% of the moon's beautiful face will be illuminated. And Mahealani, literally meaning heavenly haze or heavenly moonlight. This is a day that is highly recommended for any activity, any work that we might do, but it is a particularly good planting time. So if you've got them, plant them.
Excellent. Well, in the biodynamic look at things, the moon will be in Scorpio today until 1 p.m., just when the show's over, and then we'll be moving into the constellation of Sagittarius, a fire sign, making it a good time to work with our fruit plants, and this gives us an opportune time to harvest fruit. Harvesting fruit on fruit days helps it stay longer in storage, if necessary.
And certainly there's a lot of lychee and even mango coming on right now, so good to consider how to make that fruit stretch out more.
Exactly, because they don't keep very well.
Especially in our hands, or our mouths, I should say.
No doubt about it. And Saturday through Sunday, the moon will be in Capricorn and Earth sign, making it a good time to work with our root plants. And Monday, Tuesday next, moon moving into the air sign of Aquarius, which makes it a good time to work with our flowering plants. And once again, one of the finest days of the month to do practice vegetative propagation or cuttings, because you get the highest quality cutting snip during the time when the energies are in the upper parts of the plant.
Yeah, beautiful. You know, I'm just thinking about the whole connection between these farthest stars in the universe, or stars in our galaxy that we would see, some of them even galaxies themselves, and then plants, and how arcane it seems that there's this connection. But I just thought of it in a new way, which is here on this planet Earth, the plants have been evolving with these influences all the time. And so, of course, they, as they have developed through the millennia, they are reflecting those influences. It's not by chance that they would be connected, essentially.
Truthfully, I got a great book from the Regenerations book table at the last Seed Exchange called Celestial Influences on Plants. And the whole book is about just that and how these influences have changed the form, created the forms of these plants to be what they are today. So even thinking about a tree is one thing, but then there's so many different forms of trees. If we think about umbrella types like monkey pods versus a mango and the way that grows, and they have these different forms, and the evidence in the book points to that it is the celestial influences that have created those forms.
Incredible. Well, plants, as we know, are very sensitive, and we will be speaking about a particularly sensitive plant coming up. But first, we're going to have a look at some notable news. You may have heard about this story roundabout, but Robin's taken a deeper look into the research done recently on Roundup and its connection with cancer. So I'm really excited to hear about what you learned, Robin.
Yeah, and specifically glyphosate. This is from Acres USA magazine for May 2015, and the article features the World Health Organization's study about glyphosate and its connection to certain kinds of cancer. And this study was actually done by 17 independent laboratories under the purview of the World Health Organization and also the International Agency for Research on Cancer. And what they have found, that as the rise of glyphosate application, due mostly to Roundup Ready GMO crops, has risen over the last four decades, so has the incidences of particularly thyroid cancers and urinary and bladder cancers, although there are other digestive ailments that aren't necessarily cancer related that they're pretty sure there's a link to as well. Mm-hmm. The 17 independent experts who, with no conflict of interest, are responsible for this unbiased study, although Monsanto is pressuring the organizations to retract their study as invalid. And to me, that's a sure sign that there's something rotten going on there. And this is all just to say that it's more important than ever to eat organic food. I think that's really, for me, the underlying message. When we're eating soybean products, wheat products, and corn products that are not specifically labeled to be GMO-free, chances are they're conventionally farmed, and chances are some of these chemicals have found their way into the food. Mm. Now, glyphosate, ingesting glyphosate through the food is one thing, but also being the applicator, right, in unsafe practices. And I just want to let our island people who are listening out there know we love you very much, and we don't want you to get sick from spraying chemicals, so we'll ask you to reconsider using herbicides like Roundup that do contain glyphosate, mm-hmm, around your home for your own sake, for your children's sake, and then also taking another step and choosing not to eat it.
Yeah. So did the study look more at simply the effects from the consumption of glyphosate-laced,
yes,
rather than the exposure to either workers in the field or even homeowners?
Yes. It was more focused on the consumption of foods that have been treated with, mm-hmm, glyphosate.
But for people who are applying it, whether it's their job or their weekend thing, they're exposing themselves even more. And so through breathing it, through contact with the skin, it's probably getting into us even more.
And potentially, you know, young children who might be playing around out in the yard. And as we all know, smaller bodies are just more sensitive to environmental toxins. And if there's one thing I've realized is that taking care of our keiki is really important for our happy, healthy future here on Kauai. So there it is, World Health Organization with 17 independent researchers letting us know and that glyphosate is not good for us. So let's just do our best to stay away from it at all cost.
Indeed. And we know people do turn to it and other toxic products because the business of farming, the act of gardening, or even lawn maintenance can be daunting without, you know, some help. And we don't want to take shortcuts and threaten our health and the health of the environment, etc. And when it comes to pest and disease management, there are lots of opportunities, lots of low toxic opportunities to take these problems under control. And Robin and I will be focusing in on them in the month of
July.
All right. So we're going to devote the whole month of July to pest and disease, being on top of them instead of them being on top of us. And, you know, through good management of our systems, understanding what it is we're facing, and not just using sort of a wide-spectrum poison, but actually addressing the problem at its root. We're hoping that we can chart a different course. We know we can. We are. And we honor all of the agricultural producers here on Kauai and abroad that are already using low, you know, safe solutions for the environment and for us.
Yes, and, you know, not to be overlooked is the curiosity and potential of children in the garden. You know, they really want to be helpful. They want to find a place they can help. And if we've treated our gardens with some kind of environmental toxins, we may not want the keiki out there. But if we haven't, it gives us a chance to engage with the children out in the garden. Maybe they're picking the pest off, or they're picking the weeds that we thought we were spraying for. And it may not be the most efficient way to get the job done, but I think it gives the kids a sense of belonging and being a part of it. And it can also turn out to be a cool way for some family to get some time together if they lead really busy lives and people are off. It's a nice occupation. When I drive down the road and I see the older folks in their lawns picking out the weeds, and the lawns are just perfect, you know, and you know, they have the time to do that, and sometimes we can engage the whole family in it.
For sure. And want to give note, too, to Dr. Basco and his show, Pets, People, and Paradise, each and every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. He looks a lot at these different studies on glyphosate and other environmental toxin that affects human health as well as the health of our pets. I know glyphosate can have lethal consequences to dogs who enter an area that's been sprayed shortly after it's been sprayed. So just encourage folks to dial him in on a Saturday morning to get some really great information as well. And he brings a lot of good research to the forefront for us all to consider.
Yeah, great programming here at KKCR. And we're all looking for a happy, healthy island community. So thanks for being a part of it.
Yes, indeed. And to stay happy and healthy, we look to the plant world and the wisdom of plants to keep us healthy and happy. We have our favorites that we cultivate in the garden, ones that we keep, you know, on hand intentionally. And then there are some other lesser used plants that are on hand, whether we like them to or be or not in some cases. I don't know if you have eliminated this next feature plant that we'll talk about in the medicine chest, Robin, right now. But do you still have any of these friends lingering around your home?
Yes, and I will spill the beans. We are going to talk about Gila Gila. Ouch.
Owie grass.
Ouch is all I can say. And no, although we have been pretty adamant about picking it. There always seems to be more. It is definitely the plant that makes you want to put your shoes on, which is not something I necessarily love. I've always loved being barefoot. But this plant definitely hurts, although we have found that it does have some medicinal value. So maybe Paul will tell us a little bit about
that. Lots of values to this plant. And it's funny to me sometimes when a plant has such a difficult to deal with quality to it that we wind up eradicating it. And I think if the plant only knew to not bite me, then I wouldn't be out to get it.
But sure.
At any rate, certainly the heavy-duty thorns on Mimosa pudica, the variety we have here in the Hawaiian Islands, variety Unijuga, is a heavily armed prostrate plant. It grows in most cases at ground level, although if it's growing in some tall grass, it'll kind of use that grass to prop itself up and can actually attain a pretty fearsome size.
Yeah, no doubt. At least 5 feet. I've pulled ones out that were monsters.
Yeah. This plant, famous for its activity, the Hawaiian name Hila Hila means bashful, shy, ashamed. It is a cousin of Haulikoa. If you look at the flower, they're very similar. A little pom-pom flower, delicate, beautiful. Bright pink in the Hila Hila, whereas it's more of a dull white in the Haulikoa, another common weedy mimosa species. Common names beyond the Hawaiian include the sensitive plant. A lot of people I know call it owie grass, and the terrible recurved thorns can remain lodged in our skin for a while if we can't quite get at them. I have one in my foot right now that's underneath the heavy callus of the ball of my foot. I've been poking around trying to get it out for the past few days. But at any rate, I'm learning my lesson, and I have started to weed them out of my yard. And this plant is also known throughout the subtropical and tropical world, originally from Central and South America. For a long time, it's been throughout the tropics where it luxuriates. And so it has many names in many places, and certainly in the Indian subcontinent of the old world, it is known and appreciated by the Ayurvedic tradition, seen going back as early as the 16th century. Now, I don't know how exactly the plant would have arrived to India and already be known to be written about in the 16th century from South America. So that would be an interesting story to unravel. It does have a remarkable ability to close its little pinnate leaves when it's touched or disturbed, and it makes a fascinating plant, and you'll find it in botanical gardens in the temperate world because it is such a novelty. And in fact, it is marketed, which I think is a wonderful example of the American entrepreneurial spirit. It's marketed to students and teachers as a plant to teach about, you know, perhaps nature that does things you wouldn't expect. So people are selling the seeds of this terrible, ferocious plant.
It makes me cringe every time I read about it in a seed catalog, knowing how we live with it here.
Truly. Now, the act of closing up, which is reminiscent of the carnivorous plants of the flycatcher, the Venus flytrap, actually, it seems unusual, but when you think about it, this plant is a legume, and if you observe legumes at night,
I was just going to mention that
they fold up their leaves. So this is just a different circumstance, and it's actually physiologically the same thing going on. And basically, water is forced out of certain parts of the plant cells, and the leaf collapses closed. And it's thought that it's doing this to avoid herbivory or herbivores eating it, whether they be mammals, grazers like cattle, or if it's an insect as well. It's thought perhaps the reason it's doing it is that.
And so with trees like the monkey pod, those giant leguminous trees, their leaves go to sleep at night, so it's more of, right. It's affected by the sunlight.
Exactly.
Whereas with Gila Gila, it's affected by touch.
By touch motion, exactly. And they're pretty fabulous. It was shown in recent research, too, that the plants actually have a memory. So if they learn that a particular stimuli, like a drop of water, isn't actually harming the plant, then it will stop closing up when it gets that stimulus. And it even has a memory that if they change the environmental condition for a month and then they bring that stimuli back, it still doesn't close. It remembers that that drop of water isn't harming it.
Wow, and who says plants aren't intelligent? Probably has a better memory than I do.
Well, we certainly have a good memory of if we've ever been bit by this plant.
No doubt.
Livestock as well could remember it. It is reportedly toxic to them. So that gives us an indication that there's probably toxic elements that we would be well advised to consider. And so the cautionary approach would be do a lot more research before you actually use this plant. But of course, you're not going to tell the indigenous cultures of the world that about plants that they have come to know in a very intimate way. And so this plant is used in many different traditions. Doesn't really have a tradition in Hawaii that I could discover, but certainly is considered, and I really like this quote, a reservoir of significant medicinal properties. It were discovered in this plant. And this plant is rich in bioactive components. Some of them, terpenoids, flavonoids, glycosides, alkaloids, quinines, phenols, tannins, saponins, and coumarins. All different kinds of chemical constituents that produce various results. So it's really, really rich in these. Lots of pharmacological studies have been done on rodents, trying to show the various properties. And indeed, they've been shown effectiveness in wound healing, antimicrobial activity, pain reduction, anti-inflammatory, anti-fertility, anti-malarial, anti-ulcer, anti-venom, and anti-hypolipidemic, which means it prevents heart disease as well. So now this has been shown in rats. So it's a bit of a jump to say, okay, we're going to start using it, but it's that sort of base, that pharmacological study is the basis for saying this is a very promising plant to use as a basis for crude drugs and an alternative to many of the synthetic ones that have the list that goes on a mile long about how it will kill you in one way or another. And at any rate, we're always happy to see that in this modern age, in the 21st century, that people are still going back to these revered herbs and doing the base research to discover the effectiveness of them.
Yeah, sure. Maybe it would make me more inspired to go out and pick more if I knew someone was going to make an extract that could be studied. Maybe I wouldn't feel so reluctant to fill up some cans with eradicated Gila Gila.
Indeed. Well, here are some of the traditional uses now. Leaves used for increasing the sexual potency of men in one place and of women in another. I guess we need to get those two places together for like a field trip or something. Leaves and roots are used for gravel and other kidney diseases, so kidney stones and the like. Roots are also used in an oral snake bite remedy, apparently very effective against some pretty devastating snake bites. Root decoction is gargled for gum trouble and toothache. The leaves are chewed, and the resulting mush is spread onto fresh wounds to stop bleeding. Leaves are used in pillows to induce sleep in children. The paste of root fried in castor oil is applied on deep cut wounds to stop bleeding and for healing. And finally, this plant is often stated, it's often stated that this plant is a significant source of DMT. Dimethyltryptamine, a powerful hallucinogen and psychoactive substance that's used in various combinations. According, though, to the Arrowhead site, and completely legal, by the way, plants that contain DMT have been judged to not be illegal in the U.S. and other countries because it's such a common chemical compound. You'd have to make illegal, you know, so many different plants, etc. But according to Arrowid.org, and if you've never visited that site, Arrowid.org, which is a wonderful compendium of information on different psychoactive substances, plants, and personal experiences. It's sort of like a psychoactive travel log of various people's experiences with these plants. It's not conclusively the case that Gila Gila, as a member of the Mimosa genus, contains a lot of DMT. You kind of hear that, but it hasn't been borne out in clinical studies, or we don't have the results in terms of what the percentage is. So it is a source, probably, but other members of the Mimosa genus are reported to have higher amounts of this particular chemical constituent.
Wow. That's all I can say. Who knew?
And a pretty cool thing, too, as you're pulling the Gila Gila grass out, or the Gila Gila plant, out of your yard or where other places where it might be presenting a barrier to you, there's a particular scent that's emitted from the, if you smell the roots, it can be quite strong. I've been told that that's actually the nitrogen-fixing bacteria that you're smelling. You can smell the same smell in a koa forest or an albizia forest after a rain where the water is activating the microbial activity. And so at any rate, that's what I was told, was that that scent, which is very distinctive, it doesn't smell like anything else, is actually the rhizobial bacteria. Pretty cool.
Wow, I'm going to have to check that out. See, more reasons to pull Gila Gila out of the yard.
Indeed. And this is In the Garden on the Farm. On Kauai Community Radio, we're here until 1 o'clock. I'm your host, Paul.
I'm Robin.
And we are here to illuminate and elucidate some of the secrets and keys to success, we could say. I have to say that a couple of weeks ago, the sharing at Sun and Lisa's farm certainly shone a lot of light on good practices and keeping the soil in balance so that the plants are happy and healthy and strong and vibrant. Quite a fun day out there. We have an opportunity here to perhaps reach an even larger audience, so great to have Sun on the show, and then great for us to be able to dive into some of the details with you. And this month, we are focusing on
planting of all kinds, one of my favorite topics. I will definitely be looking forward to this entire month. And for starters, we want to talk a little bit about sowing and transplanting. And there'd be two different reasons, and mainly it's what our plants prefer, why we choose one over the other. And in, I believe it was February, we went into really great detail about nurseries and seed starting medium. So I'm not going to focus as much on that today as I am to talk about direct seeding versus nursery plants for transplanting. Mm-hmm. And as I see it, the distinction is made simply because the plants prefer it. We have to remember that all this stuff we're doing for the plant. The plant is the star of the show.
Indeed, and they do have their own particular desires of how they would grow to their best effect. And so one of the key aspects that we look at when we're doing our planting is, are we pushing a seed under the soil to allow it to grow right in place, or are we doing a transplant? And that's based on the desire of the plant.
The desire of the plant. And so my list that I've come up with is definitely not comprehensive, but I feel it targets a lot of the common plants that we'd want to use here and or that we'd want to be growing in our gardens. And a lot of this also comes from personal experience and having done it both ways and seeing the results. And as you know, as a gardener, if you're listening, you tend to eat your mistakes. So, you know, there's no problem when you make a mistake. You're probably going to have something to eat out of it anyway. But we want to optimize our gardens. That's why we're here. That's why we're talking about it. That's why you're listening. So, for starters, beans are a good crop to be directly seeded into our prepared garden beds. Carrots, beets, radishes, turnips, so the root crops in general, really like to get their start right there in Mother Earth. Particularly at this time of year, cilantro I think does better when direct seeded and grown up than with transplants. It's a tender plant. It gets hot out there for it. Mm-hmm. And I've found that if it can grow up right in the soil from the beginning, doesn't have any transplanting trauma, the plants can be much stronger.
And as an aside, Robin, with cilantro and the fact that there's multi-embryoed seeds, do you crack them open before you sow them?
I do not, but for the first time a couple of weeks ago, I beheld what that actually looked like, and it was so adorable to see each cilantro seed basically has two embryos, mm-hmm. and to see both of them, that they were still connected, but just still sprouting out of their little half seeds. I do not bother with that. I find that they germinate just fine for me without. But a technique there would be to use a rolling pin very gently, mm-hmm. and perhaps put the seeds in a bag of some sort so they don't fly everywhere, and just gently roll them until you split those whole seeds in two.
Cool.
Greens like mescaline and also even lettuces sometimes at this time of year can be really good to direct seed. And then also noticed that okra does a lot better when the seeds are sown directly. I also do transplants, but it's pretty amazing to see the difference of how quickly one will take off from being directly seeded. And also for growing giant sunflowers, the general recommendation is direct seeding, and then here's the key word, thinning, which we're going to talk about more in a minute. But the last plant, I normally would plant tomato seeds in a container and then transplant them to have an individual tomato, but I'm sure I'm not alone that you throw some compost in your garden out of your composter and suddenly a whole little lawn of tomato seeds just sprout up out of your compost, and there they are. So using compost, I suppose, is one way to direct seed tomatoes, and if they land in the right spot, you can certainly just leave them there to grow. It's a plant I've noticed grows perfectly fine in the ground.
And when we're transplanting them, we're burying part of the vine.
That's right.
We're burying part of the stem, essentially, of the plant underground, but if it's a direct seeded plant, you're not disadvantaged by taking that step?
Well, I sure have had some volunteer tomatoes do really, really well. So judging on that, I'm going to say the tomato kind of doesn't mind either strategy. Yep. But we will get into how to transplant tomatoes a little bit later.
And stepping out of the garden for just a moment, talking about direct seeding, it's said by many fruit fanatics that very many of our fruiting trees that we would grow from seed as opposed to a graft, or even ones that we would graft eventually, are best to direct sow. Trees more often having a taproot that really can help the plant to thrive, anchor the plant in its younger age, and in all ways, if we are preparing a planting hole and, let's say, throwing down 6 or 8 seeds of our desired fruit tree, doing our selection right there in the hole, the rate of growth and the resulting health of the plant can be dramatically improved by just a direct seeding. It seems a bit counterintuitive because we're so used to transplanting trees themselves, but it is an opportunity.
It's true. I've seen it very much with avocados in particular. Now, the thing with avocado is you're not exactly sure what kind of fruit that tree will bear. If the seed is from a grafted tree, it may not necessarily represent the fruit that it came out of, but the sturdiness of an avocado seedling that's grown up right in the ground, as I'm sure many listeners can attest to, where they used to have a compost pile, is now their avocado tree. And they can be quite good or can be grafted later, but absolutely true. So another option for direct seeding is some of those trees. Now we talk about thinning. Thinning, so important. You know, for me, the garden is so symbolic of life lessons in so many ways. And think of thinning like culling. Culling is removing the parts of our lives that we don't really need anymore. Maybe it's stuff in our house or
Stuff in our truck.
Stuff in our... Yeah, yeah. And when we lay down seeds, say direct seeds, and I'll just pick out carrot as an example because I think it's a good example. The seeds are going to be pretty close together. I mean, not many people I know will direct seed with 4 inches in between each seed. You're really just going to sprinkle some seeds into a little trench in your garden bed. And when the seeds sprout, they're all going to be really close together. And it's not good practice to leave all those plants growing so close together for several reasons. One is competition for nutrients. So they won't, none of them will be able to get big. Right. If they're packed in, they're going to remain small. And also, importantly, for sanitation reasons, you need good airflow. And when plants are too crowded with one another, the air cannot move through. And I've seen it time and time again. That's exactly the place where I'm going to get pests first, is in those crowded, stuffy little areas.
Right, right.
So when it comes to radishes or turnips or even carrots, I mean, I think of it like this. Eating radish sprouts for breakfast, if you're out there thinning, and, you know, you wash them off, and that's such a nutritious breakfast. I mean, you can't buy that anywhere, really, even. I mean, I suppose there are some radish microgreens out there somewhere, but freshness-wise, thinning is important. Not everybody likes to kill plants. Not everybody wants to pull some out. They think, well, they're growing fine. Why would I? I finally got something to grow. Now you want me to take it out. But I really do maintain that that's an important part of the process. With greens and in the summer, you know, lettuces or mescaline type greens, we can just go in there and mow down with our scissors and just leave a few choice plants in between, you know, mow out little sections. And as we all know from growing mescaline seed mix, some plants get really big really fast, like the mustards, and they can dwarf out the other little lettuces or other kinds of greens that are in that mix. So there's different ways to thin. One is actually fully removing, pulling one up, you know, right from the base. If you pull it up and uproot it, that's one option. And another option is with a fine, sharp, pointed pair of scissors to go in and just cut them away. You don't actually have to uproot each one, but you'd want to cut them nice and low so they wouldn't regrow again. And leaving whatever the appropriate amount of space in between the plants are. Now, for different plants, that means different things. With sunflowers, you'd want to leave 2 feet in between each. You know, you'd thin out plants and leaving remaining plants only two feet apart.
Right.
Whereas with lettuce, you can get away with a little less, maybe 5 or 6 inches. Carrots, I think even less. You can probably get away with 4 inches between carrot plants. But you just want to think of your full-grown produce and how big do you want your beets to be. And that's how much room you should leave in between plants. And when you're thinning, I look very, very carefully. And if there's a plant that already is diseased or has mutated leaves or there's something wrong with it, those are the ones that go first. So thinning isn't just sort of a blanket thing to get rid of plants, but you want to leave the best plants. And that doesn't always work out to 4 inches apart. You never know. And sometimes they're a little offset. But really, when I'm thinning, I'm looking through and I'm going to leave the biggest and nicest of all of them. And the little ones that got dwarfed out really early by surrounding plants, those are out of there. Sometimes they're edible. Sometimes they're not. You know, we have to remember our compost is always hungry, too. And they make really great compost or vermicompost if you have worms. Sprouts are some really excellent food for them.
I've noticed in the thinning in the garden bed how important it's been to make sure first backing up that really nice soil preparation so that you have a very fine granule seed bed, as well as that the soil is moist enough. Because if you have larger composites or particulars, chunks of soil, if you will, when you're thinning, you can pull out the whole row of that section, especially if it's dry. So it's really important to have it in a good condition for your pulling.
Definitely. Absolutely. So hopefully you've been convinced that thinning is a good idea. And we'll move on to some plants, kinds of plants that are better for transplanting. And to me, this is pretty intuitive because most of these plants, and again, my list is not comprehensive at all. It's just a few varieties that I thought would make good examples. But plants that get big, they just simply need more space to grow. They need more space to live. And so a lot of times this is why I would do a transplant, because I don't necessarily want to direct sow an entire row of peppers and then, you know, remove and thin out half of the pepper seed I just bought.
Right.
So I would instead carefully plant just a few seeds in a nursery pot and get them grown up before I would transplant them into well-prepared soil. So peppers, eggplants, cucumbers, all sorts of kales and collards, broccoli, and even Swiss chard are plants that I definitely prefer to plant transplants. Tomatoes, too, if they haven't already sprouted up out of your compost and you're looking for a particular variety, that's another plant, because a tomato plant can take up, you know, 6 feet of space.
Right.
And really on a nice trellis, a couple of tomato plants at 6 feet apart, they have their space to grow well.
Right.
They're not crowded.
Right.
We're not going to get a lot of clustering of leaves and too much and moisture that are going to damage the plants. But giving these plants room, peppers, they're going to take up 2 or 3 feet each. A nice eggplant, if you take care of it over the course of 3 years, it can reach 4 feet tall easily.
Yep.
And that it can be variety specific too.
And it seems that many of these plants you're listening to, when they are small, until a certain point, they grow, they expand in size slowly. By the time you're ready to transplant them out, they're going to have rapid growth, which means that they'll also compete well with weeds. But if you're waiting for a pepper plant to grow up as a direct seeded plant, you're going to be battling weeds during that establishment period for a long
yes,
time.
You will.
It's going to be a hard battle potentially.
Yes, you will. It can be almost 3 weeks for a pepper seed to even sprout, and then you're just looking at two little cotyledons. Mm-hmm. And in the early time, yeah, they're going to grow really slow, and they do reach this point where they just kind of explode.
Right.
To me, that's the crucial timing. That's right when I like to get them in the ground.
Right.
It's right when they're about to explode, and you will have a lot less weeding to do. So on that note, well-prepared soil, you want to have your nutrients and amendments. We spent last month of May talking a lot about our soils and how to amend them. If you have time to sort of cook them in there for a while, add the amendments and wait, say, a week or longer even. But if you don't have that luxury, that's fine too. I've had great success with amending the beds and planting right into them as well. But some people are big proponents of letting it cook down in there. You want to have the soil nice and moist. And if I'm going to use mulch, I actually prefer to prepare the bed, mulch it, and then plant.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just move little spots of the mulch aside and plant into it, because if we're talking about small, cakey plants, the mulching process can be pretty devastating. You know, say if a whole bunch of it falls on top of it,
right.
It could easily break.
Or it's just a pain in the acole trying to get it around all the plants.
Well, right, which you start out really careful usually, and then by the end of the job, you're kind of feeling a little more like, let's get this done, and maybe a little sloppier. So I really, I can recommend, I've had great success of amending my soil, then laying down a nice bed of mulch, and just planting into the mulch at the correct spacing and timing. You know, choosing the time of day that we want to plant out. And as you know, we're big proponents of the lunar cycles. And so considering also the lunar position can be really helpful in transplanting successfully.
Yeah. Paying attention to those lunar cycles or those celestial influences, it's kind of like taking a vitamin pill. Maybe you can't pinpoint it and say, this is why I feel so healthy, but you know that if you're taking it, you're contributing to the health, you're contributing to the success. So if it's convenient and you can do it, and you listen to the show and you get the recommendations, try it out.
Yeah, why not? And so I'd like to talk about this great story about transplanting bananas that comes from a very beloved book to us called Native Planters of Hawaii. And it's about bananas. This particular story is about bananas, but I think you could probably apply this to just about any transplanting. And the recommendation is in the story that you dig your holes in the morning. So you wake up, you got lots of energy, and take some nice big holes for your plants to go into. And then you take a break and you eat a really nice meal. You eat your lunch and you're full. You're full. You've been fed. You're full. It's a good energy to pass on to the plant that you're about to plant. You want your plant to be full too. So you're full. You're the friend. You're the relative. You're taking care of the plant. So you put the plant in the ground. You've got a nice full tummy. And in the case of bananas, it's recommended to plant them at high noon, mm-hmm. when there is no shadow being cast in any direction from the tree you're planting. Mm-hmm. And the methodology here, I believe, is that, or the story goes, that whichever way the shadow is leaning, if you weren't to plant it at noon, is the way that the tree would blow over in the wind when there was a windstorm. Mm-hmm. And so if we plant at high noon when there's absolutely no shadow, your plant will not be blown over in the wind.
And as you heard, if you listened to the show last week, you heard us talk about the Lahaina moon, which is actually the time in the tropics where the sun is actually directly overhead, just happened this past Monday, coinciding with the Hua moon, the perfect moon for planting bananas. But this being Mahealani, still perfect. And if you're listening to the show now, it's probably exactly the time to be planting. So if you've got a shovel nearby, or maybe even tomorrow, you'll have a great time. The Mahealani influence will still be happening tomorrow at noon. And, yeah, definitely, you know, a great example of how timing and certainly a plant like a banana can withstand the full sun's energies upon planting, whereas many of our garden vegetables, that's absolutely not the time to be planting them.
Yes, often that is the case.
Oftentimes when we have our plants out of our cell trays, if we turn our back on them for just a minute or two in the hot sun and those roots are exposed, it can be pretty hardcore to the plants. It's good to be able to provide them a bit of shade right in your area. I really like seeing people use the technique of the 10x10 pop-up that they just stick over the garden bed so both the plants and themselves are in the shade while they're working. That's a pretty cool system. But, yeah. Of course, you can wait till later in the day or start early in the morning to achieve the same effect.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to lead us right into our Secrets of the Soil Builders, very related to talking about transplanting. We're going to talk about transplant shock reducers and vitamin B, which a lot of us have heard it is really good for transplant shock. But I did a little digging, so to speak, and found out that vitamin B, which when we're talking about plants, we're going to be talking about thiamine specifically. It doesn't actually do much on its own as a just vitamin B to your transplant. It has to be combined with other things in order to really be effective. And the research is that nitrogen fertilizer is adequate, and recommending that even avoiding the use of transplant fertilizers that are marketed that contain phosphates, although phosphorus we know is good for promoting blooms in plants, it also can promote rooting, but that's a little bit of a misnomer. It's tuber formation, not so much micro.
And tubers are not roots, actually.
Tubers are technically not roots. That's correct. So as far as young, new root growth and root hair formation, phosphate, phosphorus is not really effective for that. Mm. And that nitrogen fertilizer is actually more effective for that.
Okay.
And healthy plants will synthesize their own thiamine. So we want to be transplanting healthy transplants to begin with. I know it does happen. There's a plant we're trying to save. It's not so happy. We think maybe we can do something for it. And we are going to lay down some techniques for you on how to have really successful transplanting. But I also want to say that healthy soils contain beneficial microbes that also synthesize thiamine themselves. And so one of the most important factors in successful transplanting is adequate soil moisture. It's crucial for new root growth. So irrigate new plantings frequently and use mulch to hold in the soil moisture that's already there. Water and roots, good friends.
If you can and you don't have the chicken problems that we've been having.
Yes.
The fence went up, the fence came down, the chickens got in, they could even fly in, and now I'm wishing I hadn't used mulch altogether, but we've got the automatic irrigation going now so we can keep that soil moisture in a good condition, but boy, it's the chicken or the egg with all of that stuff.
Yeah, I do. I understand that there's a real quandary about to use mulch or not. I mean, a lot of times in a place where chickens haven't been active, you'd lay down some mulch and here they come. And it can actually wind up causing more problems, but adequate soil moisture being the key there. And so we're going to talk about technique when we're transplanting a plant. Let's say we've got a pretty nice looking fruit tree in a nice tree sleeve pot. And, you know, it's not going to just pull out of there. And often, you know, the technique is like slam the pot on the ground a few times to loosen it. Well, I got to say that I think it's more intelligent to cut the pot than to damage the plant. Mm. The plant is the star of the show. Like I said, it's what it's all about. We could let go of a $1 or $2 plastic pot because that's not the point, is to keep the pot. The point is to put our great tree in the ground without being shocked. So if you beat the plant up upon transplanting and think that you can just put some magic solution on there that'll make the transplant better, I'm here to tell you it doesn't really go like that. Right. We want to be really careful. We want to not disturb the root ball of the plant because sometimes there's small, very delicate roots on the very outer edges that are our feeder roots. We want those. We want those in really perfect condition.
Right.
Once we get them into the planting hole.
Now, what about the decision to be made about a plant that looks like it's root bound? The root, the taproot potentially is even twisted, or a herbaceous plant, a garden plant that's been in a 3-inch pot. Maybe we waited a little too long, and now that root ball seems pretty dense. And the question is, will the roots escape this mat?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I know also it can be common practice to just make some cuts with your clippers or a knife of some sort, or massaging some of those roots out from being bound up. With herbaceous plants, I'd be more willing to take the chance. But with a fruit tree, this is a long-term picture here.
Right.
And I probably would not want to plant a fruit tree that I saw was really, really root bound.
Right.
Now, I know that sounds wasteful, like, well, what am I going to do with this tree? But it's just lessons learned. And if you go through a lot of work and you're going to have a lot of time involved in growing this tree out, I'd say you really want to start with the most healthy specimen in perfect condition as you could.
Uh-huh.
Now, I would say if I were faced with the situation of, okay, but this is my tree and I'm going to plant it, I probably would, with a fruit tree, massage some of those roots free, see what I could do about the taproot without damaging it, of course.
Right.
This is one thing we don't want to ever do, is damage the taproot of trees, bigger specimens.
Mm.
And another factor involved would be if the plant wasn't already inoculated with mycorrhiza. Mycorrhiza is very, very beneficial to plant roots as well. If the plant hasn't already been inoculated, you might want to consider making a dip, a root dip, with maybe a teaspoon or so of mycorrhiza powder in some water, dissolving it and just dipping or drenching the roots of the plant, because mycorrhiza will be activated upon contact with living plant roots.
Mm-hmm.
So when you've seen the photos of plants grown with mycorrhiza and without, to me, there's no question that I want mycorrhiza. The plants definitely have more nutrient gathering capacity when they're associated with those mycorrhiza funguses.
But wait a minute. Aren't those the same pictures that we see of the with the vitamin B solution and without.
Yes, it's very likely true. So I just maintain that good technique is the most important part of transplanting. Prepare your soil well. Mm. Take extreme care and caution when you're handling the plant to be transplanted, the way you take it out of the pot.
Mm-hmm.
Really cut the pot. It's okay to cut the pot.
Right.
Massage it if you need be, if it looks like that. And another little factor is I used to be in the heal it in school of transplanting, where as you're backfilling the plant, you're with a big tree, you're using your heels and your feet and you're stomping the soil in really tight around the root ball. And a really dear friend of mine asked me, why was I doing that? I was making it so hard for those new roots to get out into that soil. Mm-hmm. And unless the plant is in a really high wind situation, that healing it in story I don't think really needs to be told. I think leaving the soil rather loose around the plant so those new roots have an easy place to go. Lord knows they're going to find the native soil, you know, soon, depending on how sizable your hole is. And they're going to have to face the real world of what real compacted soil is all about.
Well, that soil's going to compact faster than you want without your help anyway.
Yes.
It's remarkable how fast it can collapse, you know. Oh, this was such a fluffy place, and now, whoa.
Yeah, water alone will do that. So we don't need to pound in any soil. And gosh, I know I could go on and on about this, some of my favorite topics here, but I think we're reaching the end of our hour.
This has been In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio. We've had a lot of fun chatting with you this hour. Please tune in again next week. And before we go, we want to let you know that previous shows, we reference shows of the past. They're all up on the archive at kkcr.org. Go to the main page, look for the audio archive tab. Click that, and you'll find a plethora of shows. Thanks so much to our engineer, Jack, our phone tech, Mac, our webmaster, Laura Christine, our station manager, Dean, all the great programmers, Dove, our volunteer guider. And we're just so grateful to be part of this station, part of the community with you and with the plants and with all of life. And we invite you to tune in again next week for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the life of the land that gives us life. Aloha, everyone.
Aloha.